We get it underway this afternoon by welcoming to the program a singer, songwriter, and musician who has written hits for an incredibly diverse group of artists, from Anne Murray to Toto, England Tan and John Ford Coley, Garth Brooks, Steve Perry, Michael McDonald, on and on. He's also got a brand new solo album out right now called Red Eye. We are pleased to welcome to the show Randy Goodrum. Hey, Randy, thank you so much for making some time for us today.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
We had to get you on our show because your name keeps coming up. I can't tell you how many guests have mentioned you through the years. Most recently, Steve Lukather and Radney Foster.
Oh, yeah. Oh, me darn. Wow. Yeah, a couple of old friends. Absolutely.
Well, you've worked with everybody through the years, and I want to talk about your new album in a little bit, but I'd like to go back to the beginning and trace through the career. How old were you when you first learned to play the piano?
Oh, I was able to reach the keyboard, and my brother, actually 5 years older than me, I was trying to imitate him. He was he was a big blues fan. He would listen to blues at night on the AM radio and then come into the piano and start playing it. And so I would get because there were fewer black keys, I learned to play in all the black keys, like F sharp, C sharp, whatever. I didn't know. There wasn't anybody saying, hey, are you crazy, man? You should be playing in C. But, I played by ear like my brother did, and eventually my parents blessed me with piano lessons, which lasted for maybe 2-3 years before I said, are you kidding? I'm going to go play football and golf and all the other stuff. And so eventually, about 7th grade, 8th grade, whatever, I was starting to really get deeper and deeper into especially jazz. I was devouring all these jazz records and so forth and trying to learn all the stuff that Herbie Hancock and Oscar Peterson and Wynton Kelly, all the really great players, I was trying to figure out how they were doing what they did. So I begged my parents. I was probably the only person I've ever seen on planet Earth who did this. I begged them to give me piano lessons again. That's one of those things you never see in science. And they did. And so I ended up actually... I'm going to try to make a really long story short, which is hard for me, but I ended up majoring in piano in college, and which my parents had given me the support years before when I told them I was thinking of going into music instead of being a doctor like my dad, because they knew that's what I really wanted to do, was do something in music. I don't know what, but... So I thought the logical thing to do was just be as good a piano player as I could possibly be. And so I actually ended up preparing myself for a career as a pianist, which I did for a lot of years. In college, I stumbled across songwriting, and which I could go into if you want. But it's
I want to go back to high school just briefly, because while you were in high school, you formed a trio, the Three Kings, with a sax player who went on to do some things beyond the music world of note.
Yeah, we decided I would be the piano player, Joe Newman would be the drummer, and Bill Clinton would be the president. he called me, and he was older than me one whole year, and he he called me and says, "Hey, I hear you play really well by ear, and you know a lot of the old standards and so forth. You're a jazz player." And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, we want to form this little group." And so we had piano, drums, and sax, because it was a small town. We didn't have any bass players, anybody that could play bass or electric bass. That was okay. And it was the first time I'd ever been in a band that we played in front of people and got feedback from the audience. So it was a real important event for me. And actually, Bill was very seriously considering going into music himself. He was an all-state tenor sax player, high school, and all that. That was sort of like all-American athlete or whatever. He could sight read anything and all that. but he later made a career move to something more lucrative, I think. Not even lucrative. He was always the president of that. Wherever in a meeting we had to pick somebody to lead the meeting, it was always Bill. So
he did okay for himself. Now, you talk about this in a song on the new album, The Hub, but you grew up in an area that had so many different musical influences. How important was that to your development as an artist?
It is the biggest blessing I could ever have, growing up in Central Arkansas, because what I said in that song was, every night, what my brother used to drive me crazy, but he was older than me and bigger, so I couldn't talk back to him. So he would turn on either WNOE in New Orleans or WLS in Chicago or WLAC at night, which played black blues at the time. This was late 50s. Or KMOX in Kansas City. You know, we had all these great stations. They were clear channel, and you could hear all this great music, and that's what we went to bed listening to. And after a while, I developed a taste. I got to where I could actually understand what the blues guys were saying. And I fell in love with that. I was very influenced by that. That was a real fundamental influence on me. And the thing is, in the South, or Central Arkansas, where I grew up, a lot of that music originated from that region. And I didn't really understand the import of that until I was stationed in Germany in the Army. And I was in the Army band, luckily. And I was going into Stuttgart. I was stationed outside of Stuttgart. And I would sit in with these various groups. And they always called us to come back. There was a tenor player from Dallas who played like Coltrane. And we would sit in with all these groups. And they started hiring us for jobs. And one night I asked the bass player, this Austrian guy, says, "Why are you hiring me?" I said, "Your piano player is better than I am." She says, "No, but you're from the South. Did you guys have something that we can only imitate or synthesize?" It said, "But when you're in the group, it rubs off on it." And I thought, hey, there's something to being from where I'm from that is a good thing. So I savored that. And it's actually come in handy even in my songwriting career. I recognize that as a rare spice that it helps to kind of be born with or from.
Do you think of yourself primarily still as a jazz musician?
It depends on what day I wake up. I mean, some days I wake up a jazz musician, jazz pianist. But the thing is that songwriting, at least my approach to it, I never did the journeyman process of being a songwriter. I was asked in college to help a buddy write a musical because he didn't have time. And I told him, I said, I'm not a writer. I don't know why you want to ask me. And he says, "Yeah, but you're a jazz guy. You know how to make stuff up from nothing." And he said, "That's kind of what writing is, right?" And I said, "Well, I guess it is. I don't know. We'll see." So I said, "I'll give you a day and we'll try and see what goes on." And so after two or three days, I was really starting to love it. I said, "Well, I like this songwriting thing. It's like jazz, where you look at a premise in the script." We had the script already. So when you know what the song's about, you just sort of go into your life experience and you make stuff up or you pull something that's really happened. And then the music part was easy because, you know, if you're a jazz player, you're always, you know, doing a play on whatever the melody is or the chords are and improvising, right? So I use the same ethic I used in jazz, which is to never be derivative. Always try to do something that's super original, and also to really do you, whatever your point of view is, and not try to do a Jimmy Webb clone or a Randy Newman or whatever. And so that's always been my approach to writing songs. Period. So sometimes I can go over into that form of writing a jazz-ish song real easily. But because I grew up where I grew up and when I was playing gigs, I had to be able to play country, jazz, polkas, anything. I played all kinds of possible types of venues and groups of people. So it was, that all came in handy.
We're talking with Randy Goodrum here on Downtown. You've said at its best, songwriting is conversational. And when I think of your lyrics, I think of what I would call an elegant simplicity to your lyrics.
Well, a lot of that was a rub off of living in Nashville, because when I got out of the Army, I tried to figure out where I was going to start my career. I knew by then that I did want to possibly be somewhere where, if I did develop as a songwriter enough, I'd be in a good spot. So I figured L.A. I looked at L.A. I didn't feel like I was ready for that place. I also felt like that place was such a strong influence that I would end up being a clone of somebody out there. And so Nashville, a friend of mine, said, I want you to come check Nashville out. And I said, well, I'm not country. You know, there's not anything about me that's country. And he goes, yeah, but we do all kinds of stuff here. Who knows? And he was an old musician friend, fishing buddy, whatever, I knew from Hot Springs, where I grew up, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And he had done pretty well there. And so he said, tell you what, just come over and look, check it out, and you can stay at my house and see what you think. So I went over there, and he had done pretty well. He was producing records and jingles and so forth.
Now, was that Bob Millsap?
So he hired me. Yes, he hired me on a jingle session. And he said, just go out and sit behind the Hammond and do something. And so when I heard the playback of the track and heard my playing, I suddenly got a new bug that bit. This is after the songwriting bug had bit years before. So I said, hey, this could be another page. I could maybe pursue being a studio musician. And so I started going back over to Nashville more and more and more. Bob took a liking to my music. It wasn't really, it was kind of hybrid to anything he'd ever heard. He knew it was not quite pop. It wasn't country. What he told me, he says, look, Rand, he says, I'm not really sure what it is. All I know is I like it, and I'll publish some of it if you'd like, which was a blessing for me because it meant that he would pay for some demos, pitch it around. I didn't have any contacts. So he ended up publishing some of my earlier hits, Sad to Belong and You Needed Me, President.
It's hard to imagine this now because of the success that it enjoyed, but You Needed Me, which became just a mega hit for Ann Murray, but was a tough sell at first.
Oh, my God, yes. Nobody wanted that song. I mean, Ann will even... I saw finally in a video recently that she did describing the story of how she found the song, and which we mailed, by the way, regular mail. Anyway, she recognized at the time that the same thing I ran into, that it didn't have a chorus. It's verse, bridge, verse. But, you know, me growing up with the old standards, you know, Cole Porter and all those kind of people, a lot of us are that way. And also, even more recently, like When Sunny Gets Blue, has exactly the same form. And so, you know, I used to tell that to people in pitch meeting. I learned fast not to tell that because that would be when the pitch meeting ended, usually. You don't want to tell the guy who's saying, hey, your song doesn't have a chorus. You go, well, you know, a lot of songs don't have choruses. No. wrong thing to say, songwriters out there.
But anyway...
Ann didn't care. She just said, it doesn't have a chorus, but it doesn't need one. So, and most people don't call me up and say, you know, I was going to buy that song, but it doesn't have a chorus, so I passed. I never heard that.
A great string of hits in the late 1970s, early 80s for you. I also broadcast college football, and my broadcast partner and I have a unique way of warming up before we go on the air. We like to sing, get our headphones on, yeah, and sing, and I'm pretty sure we're the only football broadcasters in America that one of our favorite warm-ups is to try and harmonize on your song Bluer Than Blue.
Oh, that's very nice.
I don't think there's another crew out there that's sitting in the football stadium. Yeah, I don't have to miss no TV shows.
Yeah, that was another hard one. It was too hip for Nashville, I think, at the time. But you know what? An interesting thing happened when I moved there in the 70s. I was kind of part of that, I think. But there were groups that were, there was a sort of a hybrid pop that was going on. Dr. Hook, Dave Loggins, England Dan, Gene Cotton. There's a number of people like that who were creating this kind of pop music that really was, I mean, Dobie Gray, there's another one, that was a product of Nashville at the time. And it really was sort of a 360-degree music city at that time. And so there were a handful of people, Brent Mayer, Steve Gibson, Kyle Lenning, who were able to straddle and do, you know, their country work, and they could also do some pop things. And Brent Mayer, at the end of a Dave Loggins session, I was playing piano in the Dave Loggins session. I was still a studio musician. I asked Brent, who was one of the few people that, you know, I would play my songs for, and he would just, he had an open mind. He said, sure, I'll tell you what I think, whatever. So one night I played him Bluer Than Blue. At the end of the song, it was like 1 in the morning, I think, the end of the session. And you got a minute? He goes, sure. So I played him Bluer Than Blue, and he just fell out of his chair, and he said, play it again. And I kept playing it again, and playing it again, playing it again. Finally, he recorded it. He said, you mind if I just kind of toss this around and or put it in my pocket and see if I can help you find a home for it? I said, are you kidding? So he ended up calling me one day and he said, hey, there's this guy who in Minnesota who wants to give a whack at pop radio. He's got a deal on EMI, and you think we could try Bluer Than Blue? And I said, twist my arm. Oh, yes, you can do it. And it was Michael Johnson. And so I just, in the right place at the right time, you know. It's like Gail says of my wife. People say, man, Randy's been so lucky. And I said, yeah, you know, it's funny. The harder he works, the luckier he gets.
You also in Nashville found a new friend and a mentor as well. Can you talk about the role of the great Chet Atkins played in your career?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Chet because, yeah, Chet was, oh, my God, I could tell so many Chet stories. But I have a Portland, Maine story, which is very important, and I'll end with that.
Oh, yeah.
But first of all, the way this was a blessing just fell out of the sky. I was playing with Jerry Reed on the road. I had been working with Roy Orbison, and I got a chance to audition for Jerry Reed's band. A lot of people thought I was nuts. They said, why are you leaving Roy Orbison? Well, it was a great gig, but I thought Jerry was this genius guitar player. And he was, you know, he was kind of a bebopper guitar player / country or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
So I said, I've just got to try this. The musician in me won't let me not audition. So I joined his band. Chet was his producer. So the audition song that they were working on was this insane song called Lightning Rod, which was so fast. It was probably the highest metronome setting before infinity. and so there was this one section which was going to be some kind of a solo. I don't know what it was. So I told Jerry, I said, do you mind if I kind of woodshed a piano solo section for this or something? And he goes, why not? So I came back and played it for him, and he took me over to RCA, took my Fender Rhodes with me, and we plugged it in, and I played it. And so about 2 weeks later, well, first of all, that ended up being on the record. That was great. And I got to meet Chet and everything. 2 weeks later, I get a call from Chet's secretary. She says, Chet wants to hire you for a 10 o'clock session, which was one of the standard slots, 10, 2, 6, and 10. So I immediately went into first of all, it was the greatest news I'd ever heard ever in my whole career, but also it was the most frightening news I ever heard. And I thought, okay, this is make or break. So it was, the odd thing was he was the head of RCA, right? But the session was at Columbia A, their big studio. So I thought, oh, my God, there's going to be everybody there. Oh, my God, you know. So I probably didn't sleep the night before. And I got there, of course, at 9 a.m., and there was nobody there. I went into the grand piano, and I set my writing pad and and sat there just trembling. And about 3 minutes to 10, the door opens up and in walks Chet with this huge guitar case. Just Chet. That was it. And I said, what's going on? He goes, well, stay where you are. He says, I want you, you know, I heard you playing on Lightning Rod. He says, yes. Chet tells me you're somewhat of a jazz player. And I thought, yes, I am. And then I instantly thought, oh, my God, yes, I am. That's either a good thing or I've totally ended my career in Nashville. And he says, no. I like all kinds of music. And he says, matter of fact, I want you to show me some things. I want you to show me some altered chords, some altered scales and, wow, and ways to to get from this way to that way. And I said, well, so I said, okay. So I, of all things, I thought of Camp Town Races, because I remember Chet used to take these little simple songs like Glowworm or something like that and play them so elegantly. So I thought of all these strange altered chords that he could use in it. And then I showed him some different scales to use rather than just the standard diatonic scales, major and minor, and some, I showed him the diminished scales and some alternate chords to use rather than the typical progression. And so at the end of that session, which was like, I was over the moon, right? So we went and got in the elevator to go back down to the parking lot. And he said, hey, let's go grab some lunch. And I said, sure. So into the elevator before we got to the bottom on another floor, Porter Wagner steps in. And he goes, well, hi there, Chet. And he says, who you got there? And he says, who's that your friend there? And he goes, well, he's not my friend. And I thought, oh, no, I've ruined everything. Because he's not my friend, he's my teacher.
Oh, my.
And,
wow.
And Porter says, Moy says, boy, if he's your teacher, you must be something else.
What a anyway, great story.
That was my intro to Chet. But if you got a second, I can tell you this one thing.
Oh, yeah, please do.
So I had been, Chet asked me to play the road with him. And now playing the road with Chet was a wonderful thing because, first of all, he wanted a piano player like me because he not only played his country kind of stuff, but he would play all kinds of music. And sometimes he would just go off on a tangent and play, I Got It Bad, That Ain't Good, by that Ellington song, or Back Home in Indiana, whatever. And he wanted me to not have to say, how does that go? And he wanted me to, and yet I knew a lot of the old Appalachian songs that I knew all of his book and everything because I'd been playing recording sessions in Nashville for several years at that point. So here we were, and we'd also did some symphony gigs where he would supplement his a symphony with his small band, which I would be there, of course. And he always let a couple of the guys in the band, that small band, have a part of the show. Up to then, he'd been letting me do a little piano solo or something, some Scott Joplin song or something. But this particular night, here we are with a Portland Symphony, full audience. And I didn't have stage fright or anything, but I mean, it was a serious pile of people out there. And he says, well, my piano player, Randy Goodrum here, you know, he's got quite a few songs on the charts right now. He's doing quite well as a songwriter. And Randy, go ahead and do some of them. And so he just points that big Virginia ham-sized paw at me. And I said, I usually have lyric sheets in front of me, honestly, because I didn't have my lyrics memorized. But I knew the first verse and chorus of everything. So I just did a little, well, here's how I wrote this one. And then I would do a verse and a chorus. And, oh, and here's how I wrote this, blah, blah, blah. And then from then on, for several years, where I still would do an occasional show with Chet, he would always do that. Hey, Ran, you know.
Hmm. And you you produced and played on a great album of his, Chet Atkins, CGP certified guitar player. And it was just, you, Chet, and David Hungate?
Oh, yeah. I played on a lot of his records, actually. I played on that one, but I also played on several of his others, and actually wrote a lot of things with him. And he was a great mentor, and he also elevated my my session accounts quite a bit, because he started hiring me on some seriously good recording sessions with all the people he was producing. And then when I got into songwriting, of course, when I started having success as a songwriter, I really had to hang that career up, because I needed to be as available for songwriting as I did as a studio musician. The ethic of being a studio player was you had to be 100% available, and I wasn't at that point, so, you know.
We're talking with Randy Goodrum here on Downtown. How did you get together with Steve Perry?
You know, it's one of those things. I had gone up to White Plains, New York, to play piano on a record for Michael Johnson. He had supplemented the band that the producers had put together with a couple of people that Michael wanted. I was one of them. So I was up there, and I worked with this wonderful drummer named Andy Newmark. And we were hitting it off and whatever. So we became friends, like you do with other studio players you work with. And a couple of years go by, and Gail and I have sort of run our course in Nashville and realized that we were going to have to move, because my career was becoming more writing for the pop market. And that I felt that window closing quite a bit in Nashville at that time. There was a kind of a shift there, I thought, I perceived. So I had a choice of either moving to L.A. or the New York area. And I had two very precocious girls who were doing really well and very smart and in school. And so, I don't know, we moved to Westport, Connecticut. And so we wanted to work out of New York for a while and see how that shook out. So we were living there, and one day, not long after I moved there, I got a phone call from Steve Perry. And he said, you know, I'm doing this solo record, and my friend Andy Newmark told me that I should call you. You needed to write with somebody like me. And he told me about some of the songs you've written. Would you be interested in writing with me? I said, yeah, I think I would. And he said, when can you be here? And I said, tomorrow, okay. Sure. And he says, yeah, I can be there nine times. He says, how about we start about 11? I said, okay. So after that was, I'm making a long story short. So I got on the phone, and, you know, I ended up out there at 11. And, but, you know, before that, I thought at the time, I thought, I hope he doesn't think I'm Randy Bachman instead of Randy Goodrum. You know, kind of, I don't know, but, and I thought, you know, I thought I'd best not go out there thinking I need to write something like Journey. I don't want to write like I'm John Cain. I want to write something that's very, I'm going to offer him what I do. So I went into my piano and I kind of messed around with a couple of things, and I came up with this groove, this kind of start, which ended up being Foolish Heart. And we sat down the first day that I met the world with Steve, and I said, well, I'll just go for broke and see if he goes for it, great. If he doesn't, I got to meet Steve, and, you know, he was a real nice guy. I really liked him from the beginning. It was great. And we sat down, and next thing you know, he starts la-la doing this, you know, phonetic kind of melody with no particular words. And it evolved quickly into what became Foolish Heart. So it was interesting as he said, okay, after about an hour, he says, okay, we got that melody. That's great. Let's start another one. I said, no. No, we need to stay with this. We're onto it. We know what we got here. We know what it's about. Let's just stay with this. So that was about 11:30 we started, I guess, 11:20 in the morning. About 11 p.m., We had a, you know, cassette four-track demo of it.
Wow.
It was done. And I just told him, I said, you know, we have to ride these things out. We're never going to feel the same way any 2 days in our whole life. So we know what the song's about. We won't feel the same tomorrow. Trust me. And this was, again, part of my starting my, really honing my craft down more in Nashville, of all things, because that's where I learned to write economically, lyrically, and how to, you know, how there's a lot of power in simplicity. I learned that from Chet, really. I'll tell you one more Chet story real quick. We were going to lunch that first day that I wrote with, that I met with him, that I told you about. And on the radio, there was this ad for the Nashville Sounds, and they were playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game as in the background. And Chet says, isn't that a great song? Now, I thought to myself, does he have the driest wit? Is he pulling my leg here, or is he being serious? But I had to mull over real fast after knowing him for about an hour or so. I said, no, he's being serious. And then I stopped for a minute and I said, get off your high horse, man. Listen to what he's saying. Learn something. And then I realized how really strong and powerful Take Me Out to the Ball Game is. It's really a perfect song, if you think about it. People think it's like a nonsense, you know, silly little song. Yeah, that's why everybody in the world knows it.
Right. It's lasted 100 years for a reason.
Yes, exactly, because it's a perfect song. And so you can learn something from something like that. So, I learned a lot of fundamental things in that town. I really did.
All right, I want to make sure we talk about the new album. It's called Red Eye. It is an absolutely wonderful album that you did along with Larry Williams. The single Hocus Pocus is out right now, and it's just such a great song about the magic of finding that right person for you.
Well, it is. Now, if you kind of look at the lyrics in that song or listen to them, you realize that each one of those comparisons has a sort of a make or break. It's not a, hey, this is either going to be good or this is going to be disaster. You know, that's the kind of parallel I was trying to do lightheartedly. But, you know, that's the thing. It's songwriting is looks easy, but if you really delve into it, there's ways to do it with a lot of extra strength that's built into people who are listening to it. They know the difference in comparing one outcome to another, and so that's what I was trying to do with Hocus Pocus was have some fun with it. But also make a comparison. It's like popping jump shots from the half court line. I mean, that is, the odds of that happening are like winning a lottery ticket, really. You know, not unless you're LeBron James, maybe. But for a guy like you and me, maybe not. You know, maybe it's more like winning a lottery ticket.
Well, there's some great songs. Gravity to me sounds like a song that if it was released by Chicago would all of a sudden be a huge hit. It's got such a great jazzy feel to it.
Well, that's a great suggestion. I appreciate that. That might be my next. That might be what I do right after we talk.
I think my favorite song on the album, though, is More of This. It is. I would describe it as a classic Randy Goodrum song.
I appreciate that. I it's really hard for me to pick a favorite. They're like my children, you know. I agree with you, man. I think More of This is just. It is a very Randy Goodrum song. There are a lot of Randy Goodrum tongue in cheek. I mean, it's like We Shine is that kind of that way. And there's others that are. I mean, I've had some comments like that, and I wish I could release them all as singles, and but you know. Hopefully there's going to be people who will enjoy the record. And there are a lot of people all around the globe who are really going crazy over it. So I feel really good about it. It was a record I had to do. I mean, I needed to do a solo record the way I wanted to do it. And Larry helped me do that. I mean, Larry Williams is a genius. And it was a real blessing for me to be able to get him, twist his arm tight enough to help me do it.
Well, it really is a terrific album. I have to get your Portland, Maine story, though, before we let you go.
Well, that was the one where Chet, it was at Portland Symphony.
Oh.
Where Chet, for the first time, said, "Hey, Rand, come up and do some of your hits." And I remember the conductor. And when I did the first song, he looked over to me and he goes, and he mouthed, "You wrote that?" and I nodded and he gave me a thumbs up. And he was obviously a pop music fan, so. That made my night also.
What,
but yeah, I mean, I remember that vividly because that was, I told Chet later, I said, well, that was a kind of a risk on your part. And he goes, I knew you'd do okay.
What's that like, though? I imagine you can't travel very much without somewhere along the way hearing more than one of your songs on a radio or in an airport or just about anywhere.
Yeah, it is wonderful to have experienced that. And what's funny is I have colleagues that tour and go all over the world, and sometimes they'll be in, you know, Prague or someplace, and they'll say, "Hey, man, I just heard Haunting Me from the Dave Grusin record," you know, or they'll send me some kind of message from Russia or someplace like that, or, you know, Jakarta. Crazy. I mean, yeah, it's wonderful. It really is. Makes my day.
Well, I've enjoyed your music for many, many years, as long as I think from the first single when I was working in country radio and pop radio, and that England Dan and John Ford Coley song came out, and noticed that name, and it just kept appearing more and more, and then you would show up playing on the albums of people I really loved and respected, and I thought, This guy's got something going there, and it's so great to have you continuing to write and perform and make great music of your own with the new album Red Eye. And after all these years, it's fun to finally have the chance to talk with you.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time.
All right, you be well, stay safe, and good luck with the new record Red Eye. We look forward to hearing more of it on radios all around.
Thank you.
It's Randy Goodrum here on Downtown. You know, have you experienced, so many of us have, with a high school band? That you form a trio with the future president of the United States. Interesting. I mean, we knew if Bill Clinton could play the sax, didn't know he was that good, that he was an all-state player back in high school. Very interesting.
Yeah.
How about that? Randy Goodrum on Downtown.